Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We often talk about hot conflicts like Syria or Yemen, where there are shooting wars. But today on Global Journalist, we're going to talk about a standoff that could quickly evolve into the world's next major humanitarian catastrophe. That is in the tiny Central African nation of Burundi, just south of Rwanda. Like Rwanda, in Burundi in the 1990s, ethnic Hutus and Tutsis battled each other in a civil war that left hundreds of thousands of people dead. In 2005, the country began to stabilize. It passed a new constitution that would give representation in the government and military to both Hutus and Tutsis. Its parliament chose a new president, Pierre Nkurunziza. Nkurunziza won a second five-year term in 2010, and many thought that was the end of his political career, as Burundi's constitution limits the president to two terms in office. But Nkurunziza ran for a third five-year term in July, arguing that since he was chosen by parliament and not directly by voters back in 2005, his first term didn't count towards term limits. That move sparked an abortive coup and violence in the streets of the capital Bujumbura that has left at least 600 people dead and caused another 250,000 to flee. As Nkurunziza's security forces increasingly crack down on his opponents, fears are growing of a new and bloody civil war in Central Africa. Those fears have only been heightened by the region's recent history of genocide and ethnic cleansing. Today on Global Journalist, a look at Burundi. We've got a packed show today. Joining us first from London is Nkem Ifijika. He's a presenter and reporter for the BBC World Service who was just in Burundi during last year's unrest. Mr. Ifijika, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Jason.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us just a little bit about what you saw, what daily life was like in Burundi when you visited.
Burundi is already one of what you describe as one of the poorest countries on earth. So, and it's one of those things which is very difficult to classify. What does that mean in practice? And I guess if you don't think about it, you don't realize it or you don't understand. So, and I'll give you this as an illustration. Driving around the city, Bujumbura, the capital, I noticed after about 3 days of being there that I had not seen any Mercedes-Benz cars. In fact, I had seen just one. And that might seem like a trivial thing. I mean, after all, not everywhere should have luxury cars. But it's just to show you the levels of poverty that you have there, that luxury cars are just very few and far between. It was just one that I saw in my time there. So it's already a poor country. And then when it comes to things like transportation and getting around the city, most people, the vast majority of people, will use either buses or bicycle taxis because normal taxis are expensive. So you sit on the back of a bicycle and a man, and they're usually men, rides you or cycles you around the city and around the area. So it's already a poor country. And then what you then notice is people driving around at high speed, armed to the teeth in the back of pickup trucks. That was a regular occurrence. You saw that all the time. And you would see barriers forming at the edges of streets, barbed wires on the floor.
And wait, who are these people that are driving around at high speed in the back of pickup trucks?
Security forces. Security forces armed with guns. It's not something which is, on the whole, odd to see in some African countries. But it was significant in Burundi because there was a bit of tension. So there were checkpoints or soldiers rather and police officers stationed every few meters on all the major roads. You could see them, they were very visible. And then in residential neighborhoods you had barriers of trying to stop people from getting into those neighborhoods. And I remember having gone to the president's office to conduct an interview with his spokesman, and as soon as any relatively minor civil servant is about to go out into the city, a convoy of squad cars follows him because of security, because of how tense people were. And so there was security everywhere. Security had been stepped up.
And so, were you aware that there was actually violence while you were there? Was there explosions?
Well, I was just coming to that. So every night you would hear stories, or rather every morning when you woke up, you'd hear stories of 4 bodies had been found here, 3 bodies had been found here. There was a grenade attack here and there. And I think on one of the nights when we were there, we actually heard the gunfire coming from a neighborhood about 1 mile from where we were staying. And then you looked out into the night sky. This was about 10:30, 11 p.m. at night. And you looked out into the night sky, and you could see the tracer fire going out into the night. And this is what you see in a war zone. You find trace of fire in a war zone, not in a country which is at peace with itself or where there isn't any unrest. So the next morning, after we'd heard that gunfire in the morning, they said a few bodies had turned up as well. So this was what you witnessed constantly. So you heard the stories, and then we also heard the gunfire as well.
And as you spoke to people traveling around Burundi as a foreigner, did they talk about this conflict in terms of it being mainly a political conflict, or did they view it as an ethnic communal conflict between Hutus and Tutsis?
I think people were very sensitive, and people understand and realize what the stakes are. So they're careful not to paint this in terms which would basically open a box which cannot be repacked. So they said for now it was a political issue, and I'm sure some of our other guests will be able to expand on this, because steps have been taken to make sure that the makeup of Burundi's parliament, army, civil society, education sector is not made up of one ethnicity. And that's because of the unrest in the history of the country. So it's not yet, from my understanding, it is not yet at the stage where it is an ethnic conflict yet. But then the language and the rhetoric by some of the politicians was something which gave rise to the feeling that perhaps this could become an ethnic conflict. And because of the history, because of its makeup, because of its ties to Rwanda, for example, there are those fears and those worries that could tilt. But for now, it is not there yet. But that does not mean that it cannot change on a dime.
Nkem Ifejike, thanks so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
My pleasure.
A reminder to our listeners, you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the clashes in the African nation of Burundi and how reporters there are struggling to spread information. Joining me now from Virginia, Kara Jones. She's an assistant professor of political science at Mary Baldwin College and a contributor to Foreign Policy magazine and the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog. From Washington, D.C., Michael Boyce, an advocate at Refugees International and the author of a recent report on the crisis in Burundi. And joining us from London, Elsa Buchanan, a freelance journalist who covered the unrest in Burundi last year for the International Business Times and other publications. Welcome to all of you. Kara Jones, if you want to pick up on what Nkem was speaking to briefly here about the ethnic nature of this conflict, do you see it evolving in a way where it's going to be Hutus fighting Tutsis, or is that something that is not on the table right now?
There's certainly been movement from both the government and the opposition to frame some of the violence in ethnic terms. The opposition, for example, often uses the word genocide to describe what they think might happen. The likelihood of this evolving into genocide is pretty low given the current context. But this is a way to frame a conflict in order to provoke international opposition. On the other hand, you do have the government using very highly coded ethnic language in order to provoke citizen reactions, and that has seemed to have come to naught recently. So it's not an ethnic conflict; it is a political one. But there are
so wait. So give us an example of some of that coded language, then.
So in Kirundi, the word "gukora" means to work. But given the context of the Rwandan genocide, whenever you use this verb to direct citizens, it could in fact mean to work to kill another ethnic group. And there's been speeches made by high-level government officials that use this particular verb in this manner, indicating that they, you know, might like to see ethnic violence committed between civilians of different ethnicities. And so far, civilians have avoided going to this kind of ethnic violence. And really, most, even the combatants themselves, are not framing this in ethnic terms.
And the potential then, or what may be occurring or about to occur, is that the Tutsis are being targeted or perceived as being sort of the leaders of the opposition to Nkurunziza. Is that correct? Well, Elsa Buchanan, you were in Burundi around the time of the elections last year, which the opposition boycotted. There were concerns then that the country was about to spiral into civil war even then, and yet here, 6-8 months later, that hasn't happened yet. Why not? What do you see as holding the country together?
I'd say, first of all, at the time of the elections, there was a decrease, I'd say, in the violence at the time. So I think the government was quite wary that the international community was surveying what was happening at the time and wanted to make sure the elections looked as democratic as possible. So for a few days before the elections, there was no killings reported. But the first day after the results were announced, we had the first bodies being found again. So I think at the time that the government was very kind of wary of the way the international community was looking at them. Second of all, I think a lot of Burundians today, they just want to continue with their lives. We've seen that there's been changes in Bujumbura already. People I speak to, you know, tell me things are, I wouldn't say improving because the economy is down the drain, but that the level of violence that was seen, you know, in the past 3 months has decreased. Now it's more in terms of disappearances. Less bodies are found on a daily basis. And I think a lot of Burundians want to avoid going down the same route as they did prior to 2005.
And Michael Boyce, you just wrote a lengthy report on the refugee crisis there. What is happening to force people from their homes? What sorts of threats do they face?
Well, a lot of people fleeing the Burundi crisis right now are fleeing targeted persecution, individualized persecution. So, for example, you know, a civil servant who shows up to work one day and has his boss come over to his desk and say, you need to join the president's ruling party or you're going to be in trouble. Your family will be in trouble. You'll be harmed. You know, the pressure like that, persecution like that, is forcing a lot of people to flee their homes, and not just to neighboring countries, but also internally inside Burundi. We know that there are about 250,000 refugees living outside the country, but we actually don't even know how many people are displaced within Burundi because these people are so scared that they don't even want to raise their hands and say, I'm displaced, I need help. Yeah. Some of the people that I met in Burundi last September who were displaced have now been arrested because being displaced was seen as a sign of, you know, suspicion, a sign that you've done something wrong. So it's a really difficult situation in which to identify people who need help and then to help them.
And Kara Jones, talk to us about the main opposition to Nkurunziza in Burundi right now. Who are they? What are their goals? What strategies are they using to try to oust him?
That's a really good question. The opposition in Burundi has always been fractured. And in fact, the reason why CNDD-FDD is in power is because the opposition during the civil war could actually never quite get it together as well, and they kind of emerged as the last man standing against the former government. So what you have is this constellation of political actors, some of which are involved in civil society, some of which are involved in former political movements or current political movements, and some of which are newly energized by these, what they see as violations in law. You have representation from all ethnicities, you have representation from all ages, and over the summer, their biggest kind of uniting factor was the opposition to the third term. Now, there has been an umbrella political organization, CINERED, which is based in Europe, that has emerged as kind of the voice of the opposition, but it's still unclear as to what their ultimate political goals are beyond the kind of opening of political space and perhaps even removal of Nkurunziza, which no international actors will support at this time. Nkurunziza will stay until 2020. That I think, is a guarantee. But then you have armed opposition as well. We don't know who these people are. We don't know how many there are. We just know that there are armed groups operating against the state currently.
And I want to come back to some of these armed groups in a moment. But Elsa Buchanan, I understand that there have been a number of restrictions on radio stations in Burundi. There was last year the announcement of a coup against Nkurunziza after he announced he was running for the third term. That coup failed, in essence, but radio does play sort of a key role in distributing information in this part of the world. And of course, during the Rwandan genocide, radio stations were instrumental in sort of spreading the violence there. Talk to us about sort of the restrictions and how radio is being managed there.
Well, you have to understand that in Burundi, about literacy rates were about 86%. So, in a lot of places, in 2013, I know the the average rate of people with access to internet was only 1.3% all over the country, which is small. So obviously, radio in both French and local language was always used to share knowledge, education, and was greatly used by the government. I know Reporters Without Borders was saying at the time that, you know, Burundi's press was actually, you know, I would say quite free within its fiction, but quite free. One of the issues at the time, prior to the coup, was that the five radio stations, four were closed. The only one that was remaining for a long time was the state one, the RTB, which has been described as being kind of like a voice of the government. A couple in February, the government, prior to the or just after the visit of Ban Ki-moon, announced in a sort of, let's say, leverage, that they were willing to reopen two radio stations, Rema TV and Isiango.
So for some time, there was only sort of the voice of the government on air.
Yes.
After Ban Ki-moon visited, then the government said, okay, we'll allow some other radio stations to open. But those radio stations, do they operate freely?
They used to be able to operate quite freely. At the moment, they've had to sign an undertaking, which we still believe really restricts freedom of press. That is something the government will have to discuss with the international community if the United Nations actually, I would say, raise the issue once again.
I'm going to remind our listeners that they're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the ongoing civil war in the African nation of Burundi and how reporters are struggling to spread information there. Joining us from London is Elsa Buchanan, a freelance journalist who covered the unrest in Burundi last year for the International Business Times and other news outlets. Also from Washington, Michael Boyce of Refugees International, and from Virginia, Kara Jones, an assistant professor of political science at Mary Baldwin College. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Michael Boyce, one aspect that I wanted to touch on was something that Kara Jones had raised, and that was the issue of armed groups, armed opposition to the government in Burundi. We understand that there are some guerrillas that have been training across the border in Rwanda, possibly with sort of the tacit support of the Rwandan government. What can you tell us about that from your research and reporting?
Well, what we learned is that, yes, indeed, there are opposition armed groups that are operating to a certain extent in Rwanda. And of particular concern to our organization, Refugees International, is that these armed groups appear to be recruiting amongst and pressuring refugees to join their cause. And this really flies in the face of everything that we know in international law with respect to refugee protection. And so we've been pushing quite hard the Rwandan government to make sure that this does not happen and that refugees are kept safe and protected. You know, this is a problem. This is an issue that has a long history with Burundi. During the previous civil conflicts, refugees in camps in Tanzania and elsewhere were also mobilized by various armed factions. But it's something that in history rarely ends well. It usually ends with refugee camps being militarized. It sometimes ends up with refugees being attacked because they're perceived as safe havens for soldiers or rebels. So it's really important that this recruitment not take place amongst refugee populations or within refugee sites so that these refugees can get the safety they deserve.
And Kara Jones, I'd like to hear your take as well on the role of Rwanda in this conflict. Rwanda's government is dominated primarily by Tutsis, so I think it also plays into some of the question about ethnic tensions occurring in this region.
Right. So there's been rampant rumors in Rwanda and in Burundi since before the coup, that Rwanda was helping to instigate violence and was actually pushing many of the main kind of armed opposition actors, including Alexis Sindihuje, who used to be the head of the RPA radio station in Burundi, into violence, perhaps providing them weaponry, perhaps providing them training, et cetera, et cetera. There hasn't been just a ton of empirical evidence that's come out in actually finding the linkages between the government and the armed groups, although the Refugees International report, I think, was kind of the first to provide solid evidence of that. The question remains, what will Rwanda do if the violence does break out? Both Louise Mushikiwabo, who's the foreign minister, and President Paul Kagame have both stated in no uncertain terms that any violence in Burundi would be met with a kind of swift action by the Rwandan government. So I think both Rwanda and Burundi are treading lightly at this time, although it's still kind of unclear as to the extent that the Rwandan government would support an anti-Nkurunziza group.
And Kara Jones, if you would, what about the role of the African Union in this as well? Because we understand the African Union had voted or had initially authorized 5,000 peacekeepers to be sent to Burundi. President Nkurunziza said they would be treated as invaders and Burundi would in effect fight them if they came to the country. Where does this leave the AU in all this? Because the AU has sort of a difficult history in helping presidents leave office, if you will.
Yes, this was an interesting move by the African Union, a bit of coercive diplomacy, if you will. I think that the African Union knew that this would be an uphill battle to get these peacekeepers on the ground, but I think they felt kind of painted into a corner by Nkurunziza and company's continued refusal to undertake any sort of negotiations. And what you see then is additional continued international diplomatic pressure to push Nkurunziza to the negotiating table. So you've seen Ban Ki-moon come, you've seen AU Peace and Security, you've seen Samantha Power. And I think that as far as some sort of military intervention, that's probably off the table for most international actors at this point. But I think the situation will continue to be on the forefront for both the AU and the East African community.
Elsa Buchanan, you were there as a foreign correspondent. Talk to us just a little bit about what some of the challenges are of operating in Burundi as a reporter. How did the government treat you? How did ordinary people treat you?
I'd say at first that the government was quite happy to have foreign journalists come in, especially at the time of the elections. We were being welded in wood, if you want. They were quite happy to give us interviews and wanted to really get their message out there. The only issue was when we started investigating some of the abuse, especially with the civil society and human rights organisations that were still able to operate at the time. That's when things started turning a little bit in our in favour. With, you know, the government kind of constantly saying we were lying and refusing basically to give us interviews anymore. People were very, very scared, even in July. That's before the violence really, really kicked off. But you really had a sense of fear in people. The only people who were quite happy to speak to were other journalists who were already working, in hiding, and the opposition.
And Michael Boyce, Burundi's budget is about 50% paid for by foreigners through foreign aid. You would think that donor countries would have quite a lot of leverage over the Burundian government in trying to end this crisis. Why, in spite of that, do you see that this has gone on and this refugee crisis, potential humanitarian catastrophe, seems to not be getting solved?
You might well think that these donors would have significant leverage over the Burundian government, but so far, that's not what the evidence has suggested. That's not what the Burundian government's behavior has suggested. Just this week, the European Union, which provides hundreds of millions of dollars to the Burundian government, decided that it was going to suspend that assistance because of the concerns about democratic governance and human rights in Burundi. But we have yet to see that decision or threats of that decision cause any significant change in the government's behavior. And one important thing to remember about this is that, as has been said previously on this program, Burundi is one of the poorest countries in the world. And the withdrawal of this aid is inevitably going to have consequences for the most vulnerable, for the poorest Burundians. We are already seeing access to health services drying up. I can imagine that shortly we'll see schools start to close or teachers start not showing up for school. So this is really a problem that we're going to see coming down the pike in terms of economic insecurity, food insecurity in Burundi. And so it's important that countries like the United States, as well as European nations, start funneling more money to NGOs, to UN agencies, and other actors who can independently provide help to the most vulnerable Burundians.
That can backfire, though, if I can just jump in for a minute, Michael, because the problem is that we say the budget is 50%. In actuality, it's probably closer to 80%. The Burundians have been running this on a shoestring, the Burundian government has, since June, when many forms of cooperation and many forms of funding were cut off. If the international community does try and go around, what we might push the Burundian government into doing is into negotiating with people that we don't want them negotiating with. And these are some of the more unsavory investment corporations on the continent, some of the more unsavory political actors in the international arena that might be able to come up with some funding that would lead to continued human rights abuses, would lead to continued problems in government funding, and might make a bigger mess of things than they are. So we have to walk a very fine line when it comes to both using carrots like funding opportunities along with sticks when we take them away.
And Kara Jones, our time does grow short here. We do have just about 45 seconds left. But where do you see this situation evolving over the next 2 years, 3 years? What are the chances of a coup d'etat or of all-out civil war?
Economic contraction, continued armed opposition, and basically life chugging along for Burundians, but not improving.
Elsa Buchanan, your take.
Same thing. Just going back on the economy issues. We might see more people finding maybe the rebellion attractive once they realise that the state cannot provide any more. And
I'm sorry, we seem to have lost Elsa Buchanan. Unfortunately, we're also out of time for this edition of Global Journalists. Many thanks to Nkem Ifejika, Elsa Buchanan, Kara Jones, and Michael Boyce for joining us. Global Journalists executive producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Javila Roskoskit, Dorothy Sadovic, Aaron Pelish, Joe Carey, and Ayulia Alieva. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. Until next week, for all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us.